Nary escape, no sir. Then you figure the POW was fixin' to join up with them eight saboteurs? Asked Mr. Jackson. I didn't say that, answered Mr. Blakey. Still, something's mighty fishy. Harold himself told me that the Nazi was seen sitting on his bunk at 5 o'clock. At 5:15, he was reported missing. And at 5:17, those Dobermans couldn't find a cent worth picking up. What about the train, the 5:15 to Memphis? Asked Mr. Hinkins. Mr. Blakey nodded. Gone through with a fine tooth. Why, that train was held up for better than 30 minutes in Ebo. He shook his head. No, sir, I'm telling you this was no ordinary escape. Mr. Jackson said, Quint, why don't you quit saying what it ain't and tell us what you think it is? Mr. Blakey swallowed down some excess saliva. Well, if you want my opinion, I will say this. Riker had to have help. All right. If he had help, where did he get it from? Mr. Blakey was like a champion fighter readying his knockout punch. Not from inside the camp, I'll wager, 'cause them guards are good, clean Americans. The crescent of men tightened around Blakey. If you fellers will recall, he continued, a couple of weeks ago there was this troop train that derailed in California. And before that, an Army Air Corps plane up and explodes over New Jersey. And yesterday, the very same day that Riker escapes, four Nazi saboteurs are landed on the Florida coast while four more land on Long Island. And you want to know what I think? I'm going to spell it out for you. I sincerely believe that there's a Nazi underground working in this country, and for all anybody knows, it could be working right here among us. Inside the store, I saw that the only activity was over by the hardware. Three farmers were lined up in front of a counter. My father called for Chester. The black man in his gray porter's jacket came running from the back storeroom. Yes, sir, Mr. Harry. Chester, go bring up all the 12-gauge shotgun shells we've got. Yes, sir, Mr. Harry. Two men wearing striped ties and business suits came in the door and headed directly towards my father. I followed them. Mr. Bergen? Asked the older of the men as he flipped open a small leather case. Yes, sir, I'm Harry Bergen. My father came from behind the counter to shake hands with both men. What can I do for the FBI today? I'm John Pierce. This is my partner, Phil McPhee. We're here investigating the escape of the prisoner from the POW camp.
Pierce handed my father a black-and-white glossy photograph.
Do you have any recollections of this man? Once, said my father, some POWs were brought in here to buy things, but I didn't pay much attention to what those rats looked like.
Pierce pointed to the photograph.
Look carefully, Mr. Bergen. Riker may have been acting as interpreter for the others. Oh, you know, there was one.
My father nodded his head up and down.
He was a kind of smart aleck, that one. Tried to joke with me, but I told him right off I wasn't interested in making jokes with Germans.
Pierce struck the picture with his index finger.
Is that the man who tried to joke with you? Well, he might be the one. I'll tell you fellas the truth. I didn't pay much attention to what he looked like. There was one thing I remember. I don't know if it'll help you boys much.
What? Asked Pierce.
He talked in a funny way, pretending to be a Harvard boy instead of a convict.
And there's nothing else?
No, sir. I sure wish I could be more helpful to you and Mr. Hoover, 'cause he's one of the two greatest living Americans. The other one's General MacArthur.
McPhee, who looked as though he hadn't gotten comfortably settled into his 20s yet, allowed his chest to swell to enormous proportions.
"Thank you, sir. I appreciate your saying that."
Pierce crossed the store to show the picture to my mother and Gussie Fields, who shook their heads in unison. Then Sister Parker was asked to take a look. She said no and was about to return the photo when she gave a second, more thoughtful appraisal. "You know, he looks a little something like the man Mr. Bergen's girl waited on." Sister Parker turned to find me only a step behind. She held Anton's picture aloft.
"Patty, isn't this that German you were talking and laughing with?"
The eyes of the FBI were upon me. I asked,
"Is it all right if I look?"
The older agent took the picture from Sister Parker's hand and gave it to me. As a precaution against the shakes, I let my hand rest against the top of the counter.
"Well, this might be the same prisoner I waited on. It looks like it could be him, only I don't remember his hair being so dark."
"Why didn't you say something before now?" asked McPhee. "You've been following us since we entered the store."
"I have a right to be in this store if I want to. It's my father's store."
"You were laughing with him," pressed McPhee. "Did he say something funny?"
"No."
McPhee's face came in close.
"Then why did you laugh?"
"I laughed because... the dam that kept my tears back sprang a leak. Because he didn't know what to call a pocket pencil sharpener." I hid my eyes in my hands, letting the sobs come at will, regulating their own intensity and volume. Sister Parker put her arm around me, giving me little now-now pats to my shoulder. My father's voice approached.
"What's the matter? What's happened?"
McPhee shrugged.
"We were merely asking her a few questions and..."
"They made her nervous," interrupted Sister. "Both of 'em questioning Patty like she went and took that German out of prison."
"Do you realize what you did?"
asked my father, grabbing my wrist away from my face. It vibrated wildly like the agitator from some old washing machine.
"Look at that child's hand. She's highly nervous, and I don't appreciate one bit your upsetting her. I'm going to call the FBI and ask them to give me an explanation for this."
Pierce held his head like he was holding on to a headache.
"Now, Mr. Bergen, please..."
"Don't you please me," said my father. "I want to tell you both something. I'm a Jew, and I'd rather help a mad dog escape from the pound than to help a Nazi.
Come to my house. Search it from top to bottom, attic, garage, everything." "Are you finished talking?"
asked Pierce in a voice that just missed being a shout.
"Allow me to say this. There is not the slightest suspicion against either you or your daughter. I apologize for my partner, who's new with the Bureau and sometimes gets carried away. But now that he understands the situation, I'm certain that he'll want to apologize to both you and your daughter. Don't you, McPhee?"
"Sure, I'm sorry. I didn't know the girl was a nervous wreck."
"Go wait in the car,"
barked Pierce. He turned his attention to my father.
"I'm going to have to ask you a favor. The escape of the prisoner Riker may pose a threat to the very security of this nation, and it is considered essential that he be quickly apprehended. We're working night and day to do just that. Now, with that in mind, Mr. Bergen, I'm asking you to please let me talk with your daughter. It's just possible that she might provide some useful thread of information."
I wiped away the last of the tears and said, "I'll tell you anything I can, just as long as the information is worthless." Mr. Pierce smiled.
Fine, fine. As you may have heard, we're fighting the Germans because they're bad, and if one of them gets loose, it's very, very important to catch him. The reason we have to catch him is so he can't hurt children and other people. You understand that, don't you?
Perfectly.
That's fine,
he said, taking out a yellow pencil scarred by teeth marks. Mr. Pierce jotted down a few words on a stenographic pad as I told my story. He asked me to tell it one more time, adding anything that came to mind. The second time, I remembered the color of the pocket pencil sharpener. It was red. The agent removed the pencil from between his teeth to inquire whether I had noticed if there was much money in the prisoner's wallet. I didn't remember seeing a lot of money. The agent wanted to know if I was absolutely certain that the only thing the prisoner bought was a sharpener, paper, and pencils. I thought about the pin with the circle of glass diamonds. "There was something else," I said. "Now that I think of it, the prisoner carried a large tan sack. He must have bought a straw field hat like the rest of the prisoners. Yes, I think he did."
"Would you say," asked Pierce, lowering his voice, "that there was anything peculiar in his behavior?"
"Yes, there was something out of the ordinary about him."
"What was it?"
"Politeness," I said, aware of beginning to enjoy the interview. "He was very polite." The FBI man muttered a thanks as he walked with weighted steps out of the store. Across the store, Quentin Blakey and his crescent of men came in to catch the 12 o'clock news.
"The FBI has rounded up an additional 15 spies," said the announcer's voice. "These spies were preparing to help the 8 U-boat saboteurs once they established themselves on the mainland. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover said in Washington today that the spies had enough money and weapons to carry out a 2-year reign of terror. At 2 o'clock this afternoon, Director Hoover will give a full report to the president. In Arkansas, a prisoner of war escapes," continued the announcer.
"That's us," said Mr. Blakey.
"Throughout the country, law enforcement agencies are searching for a German prisoner of war. Frederick Anton Reicher, 5 feet 10 inches, 165 pounds, vanished yesterday from a prison camp near Jenkinsville, Arkansas. The 22-year-old former Nazi soldier is dark-haired, speaks flawless English, and should be considered extremely dangerous. The weather for Little Rock and vicinity is..."
My father clicked off the radio.
"Serves them right for coddling those Nazis. Our boys sure don't get that good a treatment when they're taken prisoner."
The president of the Rotary Club nodded.
"The trouble with this country is that it's too Christian. The Bible admonishes us to turn the other cheek, but we forget that it also tells us to take a tooth for a tooth and an eye for an eye."
"I'll tell you something, George," said my father. "I don't think they ought to take prisoners. Not live ones, anyway."
There was a chorus of appreciative male laughter. One of the men suddenly gave George Hinkins an alerting poke to the ribs.
"Would you looky what's a-comin' in the door?"
She was young, wearing a tailored dress of sea green, with shoulder-length hair that bounced in rhythm with her walk. But as she came up to the male quartet, they all appeared disappointed. For what looked like a dazzling beauty at a distance was at close range only a trim figure and freshly laundered hair.
"Excuse me, gentlemen. I'm Charlene Madley of the Commercial Appeal, and I'm looking for Sheriff Caldwell. They told me you might know where I could find him."
"I haven't seen Harold since morning," said Mr. Blakey. "You fellas know where he might be?"
The town sign painter, Blister, shook his head.
I reckon with all the excitement he's busier'n a hound dog during hunting season.
I followed the lady reporter out to the sidewalk and offered to show her to Sheriff Caldwell's office. As we drove together down Main toward Front Street, I noticed an occasional cluster of men on the sidewalk. Then it struck me. Where were all the women folk? Didn't any of the town ladies have bread to buy or an electric bill to pay? It reminded me of a movie I saw. The town men were stationed with guns behind every buckboard, waiting for the Comanches to attack, while all the women and children were holed up in the saloon. The sun, when did it pull its disappearing act? The complexion of the day had changed to unrelieved grayness.
There's the jailhouse,
I said, pointing to the dirty stucco bungalow with the rippled tin roof that squatted on an open grassy space between Dr. Benson's drugstore and the Rice County National Bank. The sheriff's office is right inside, but I doubt if he's around today. She made a skillful entry into something less than a full parking space. I'll be right back, she said, which I took as an invitation to stick around. I thought about Anton, alone and getting hungrier. Just as I decided that I'd better hurry back to him with news and food, the reporter returned. Would you know how to get to the prison camp? She followed my directions through the center of town and then turned right onto Highway 64. My name is Charlene Madley, she said, pulling a cigarette from a puffy beige pocketbook, and I think it's very sweet of you to guide me around. Oh, that's okay, I said. I think it must be very interesting being a reporter. How do you become one? Charlene smiled. I could tell she liked my question. What's your name?
Patty Bergen.
Well, Patty, you need to decide whether you have the aptitude, the ability for it. A good reporter has to have enough curiosity to kill a dozen cats and a love for words. Does that sound like you, Patty?
Yes, it does, Miss Madley, really.
You call me Charlene.
Okay, Charlene.
Well, I'm very curious, and that's one of the things that upsets my father. He says that all I do is ask questions. And I do like words. I use them all the time. I said, stumbling over my enthusiasm. I laughed, and so did Charlene. What I meant to say is that, well, you'll probably think this is strange, but I read dictionaries.
Really?
I keep reading until I find a word I don't know, and then I write down the word and its meaning. I got all the way through Webster's Elementary Dictionary 2 years ago, and now I'm working my way through Webster's Collegiate. Charlene turned her eyes from the road to look at me. How did you become interested in dictionary reading?
Well, it's all mixed up with curiosity. When I read a book, I want to understand precisely what it is the writer is saying, not just almost, but precisely.
And it's the same when people are talking to you. Like a moment ago, you used the word aptitude, and because you didn't think I understood, you substituted the word ability. But you didn't actually mean ability. We both know that I don't have the ability to be a reporter today, but I just might have the aptitude.
That's very well put, said Charlene admiringly. I'll bet you're a real whiz in school.
No, I'm not.
And you're modest, too.
No, it's the truth. I'm not at all good in school. Mostly I make C's, sometimes worse. At McDonald's Dairy Barn, we left the blacktop to turn right on a dusty side road. Farther in the distance, those familiar Y-shaped posts connected a network of barbed wire which squared off the compound. Charlene brought the car to a sudden stop in front of the gate, where two rifle-carrying soldiers marched sentry duty. A third soldier stepped out of a guardhouse and threw Charlene a salute.
"Where are you going, ma'am?"
"I'm Charlene Madley, a reporter for the Memphis Commercial Appeal, and I want to see your warden."
The soldier asked us to wait while he phoned the commandant's office. Within a couple of minutes, he returned, shaking his head.
"I'm real sorry, ma'am. The commandant cannot see reporters today."
Charlene opened the car door. "You get that commandant back on the phone. I want to speak with him."
The soldier's obey reflex had been made strong by constant use. Without hesitation, he returned to the telephone.
"It's all yours, ma'am,"
he said, extending the black receiver to Charlene.
"Commandant, this is Charlene Madley of the Memphis Commercial Appeal. Commandant, I have information that suggests that the security of this prison is lax, and, of course, yes, I understand that. No, I know it isn't fair, and that's the reason I drove the 40 miles from Memphis just to get your side of the story. First barrack on the left. Thank you."
Charlene shook her head in disbelief.
The commandant just fell for the oldest newspaper trick in the world.
The first barrack on the left was indistinguishable from all the others spread around the compound, with their painted white walls. We came to a stop directly in front of a sign which stated, "Reserved for General Staff." A soldier wearing two chevrons on his sleeve approached.
"You're the reporter?"
As we followed a few steps behind him, Charlene handed me some sheets of yellow paper and a thick, eraserless pencil.
"You really want to be a reporter? Then we'll let this be your first assignment. Write down everything that you consider pertinent to the fact that a prisoner has escaped."
The name on the door read, "Major Robert E. L. Roper, Commanding." I wrote that down. He rose from his desk as we entered.
"Yes, happy to see you. Please come right in, Miss Maudley."
"Madley," corrected Charlene as she shook his extended hand.
She introduced me as her friend, Patty Bergen, who has the aptitude to become a good reporter.
"Major, what I came here to find out," said Charlene, "is how was it possible for a prisoner to escape this camp?"
He pushed some imaginary strands of hair across a hairless dome.
"We're real proud of our security system here, Miss Madley. We follow the same master plan for security as 80 similar camps across this country. The alarm system, the many security checks, the canine corps of trained Dobermans. Even the exact amount of voltage per square foot of area is written out. And I'm here to see that the orders are carried out according to the master plan."
Major Roper unrolled a blueprint of the camp.
While my writing hand was cramping from the race to get it all down, Charlene seemed to be working at a more leisurely pace. I began to worry that maybe I was doing it all wrong.
Charlene lit her own cigarette with a small gold lighter and blew smoke in the general direction of the officer.
"Then, Major Roper, how is it possible that a prisoner did, in fact, escape?"
"Well, that has not yet been fully determined. We are not in charge of the investigation. That comes under the jurisdiction of the FBI. But you should know that nothing is 100% foolproof. There's been no prison built that somebody hasn't escaped from."
Major Roper's statement seemed persuasive. I looked at Charlene to see if she too was impressed. She leaned back in her chair, stretching her legs forward.
"But, Major, is it usual to escape without even leaving a clue?"
His eyelids lowered.
"Who told you that nonsense?"
"Oh, then there were clues. Charlene's voice was positively sunny.
As I've tried to indicate to you, the FBI is in charge of the investigation, and...
Is it true, interrupted Charlene, that the dogs were unable to pick up a scent anywhere, not even from the prisoner's own bed?
Young lady, I'd like to cooperate with the press, but I will have to ask you not to write anything that would make us look foolish. I can't have shame brought down on the heads of the loyal men in my command.
Charlene lifted an eyebrow.
Let me assure you, Major, that it is not my intention to bring ridicule upon you or your men. All I want is the information so that I can bring back a story that will make my editor happy.
The officer sighed like a great weariness had overtaken him.
Very well.
He picked up an index card and read,
The escapee's name is Frederick Anton Riker. Serial number GL1877. Rank, private, German Army. Height, 5 feet 10.5 inches. Weight, 165 pounds. Age, 22. Born, Göttingen, Germany. Prison record, cooperative. Health, in May, Riker was hospitalized in the prison infirmary for appendicitis.
He pitched the card across his desk.
At exactly 4:50 yesterday afternoon, the prisoners of Barrack 314, having eaten their evening meal, filed out of mess hall. A few minutes later, Riker was sitting on his bunk with another prisoner named Blinkoff. Riker was reading his palm. At 5:17 roll call, Riker was reported missing. A general alarm was sounded and the camp dogs were immediately taken to Riker's bunk, but they were unable to get his scent. This was due, without doubt, to the fact that Riker had had three other prisoners sitting on his bed for palm readings. The dogs were hopelessly confused. A search was made for Riker's clothing and personal effects, but nothing was located.
Major Roper rotated his swivel chair toward the window. His eyes seemed to scan the grounds for the prisoner who, like a pair of reading glasses, would turn out to be only temporarily misplaced. It was Charlene who broke the spell.
Major, did Frederick Riker escape prison to join forces with the 8 saboteurs?
I have no reason to believe that.
What I would like to do now, with your permission, is to speak with some of the people who knew Riker.
Oh. Yes, indeed,
he said, pressing a button. The door opened, and the corporal appeared as quickly as a genie. Major Roper explained Charlene's request and told the soldier to offer all assistance. We followed the corporal into the outer office where he began making phone calls. A clock gave the time at 2:05. If only I could get some word to Anton. Let him know. He must be hungry and worried. The corporal hit the receiver back onto the hook.
I'm sorry. It looks like everybody's out on work detail.
Then take me over to your infirmary, said Charlene. Inside the infirmary, the smell was all soap and Lysol. The corporal led us past a ward with 2 dozen white-sheeted beds, but only 5 or 6 patients. At the end of the hall, he opened the door where a sign read, Captain Gerald S. Robinson. A crew-cut soldier with a single chevron sat in a cluttered outer office, 2-finger typing. Captain Robinson, a small, fastidious man, stood up behind a large, untidy desk when we entered.
Interesting, he said, giving Charlene a smile. The FBI hasn't yet been around to interview me, and I may have known Anton Riker as well as any American in this camp.
Lucky I found you, Doctor. Or should I call you by your military title?
Oh, you probably should, but don't.
Dr. Robinson, would you say that the escapee was a tough kind of prisoner?
He selected a pipe with a curved stem from a rack of six.
I'd say so, but not in the conventional sense. It seems to me that Riker has a toughness of mind. In medicine, when a person is in constant contact with the disease and yet is able to resist catching it himself, then he would be considered to have great resiliency or, in street parlance, toughness.
The doctor looked at Charlene.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I said with a suddenness that surprised me. His mind was strong and clear, and he didn't believe what the Nazis wanted him to believe.
More or less, said the doctor.
Then in your opinion, said Charlene, he didn't escape for the purpose of joining forces with the 8 U-boat saboteurs.
Oh, I suspect he wanted his freedom and nothing more.
But Dr. Robinson, isn't it a distinct possibility that Riker was merely faking an attitude that he could later use to advantage?
He took a long puff from his pipe. It is possible, but I doubt it. Some of our prisoners, mostly former members of the SS, are truly fanatical men. They're arrogant, and they don't care who knows it. Riker wasn't cut from that mold. He was a scholar, interested in books and ideas. And perhaps more important, he was a loner.
This is very interesting, but could you give me a concrete example of something that the prisoner said or did that gives you this impression?
Dr. Robinson leaned deep into his chair. I can't honestly remember specifically anything that he said, only...
Charlene's body pitched forward. Only what?
It was only that he seemed like a decent man.
Before the prison gate stood the same obedient sentry. His eyes swept over the blue sedan before calling,
"Proceed, ma'am,"
as Charlene blasted off, leaving behind a trail of raised dust. Charlene didn't say anything, and I was grateful for the chance to remember the doctor's words. It was then that I experienced the last of my fear taking flight. Nestling down in its place came exultation. At this moment, on a dusty back road within smelling distance of McDonald's dairy barn, I felt the greatest joy I had ever known. Chapter 10 Charlene idled the motor in front of the store.
Nice having you with me today. Would you like me to send you an autographed copy of the story?
Yes, thanks very much.
And if I can ever help you in any way...
Well, maybe I could write you a letter.
Why would she want to hear from me?
You wouldn't have to answer, well, I mean, unless you have the time.
Tell you what, next time you're planning a visit to your grandparents, write me. I'll show you around the paper. It should be very interesting for a girl who has the aptitude to become a reporter.
A reporter? Was it true that just a couple of hours ago I thought about becoming a reporter? Then the word journalist had had a ring to it, but now it's gone. A journalist's life might be fun, but fun, like champagne bubbles, can't completely fill you up. Anyway, there was something else I'd rather do with my life. I wanted to run the 2 blocks home, but I remembered Anton's advice to do what I've always done and to go where I've always gone. Be visible, he had said. Highly visible. I walked visibly into the store. He might like a couple of Hershey bars for dessert. My father's voice caught me.
What are you doing wandering around? I want you to go right home and stay there. There's a criminal loose.
Yes, sir, I know. Is it all right if I fool around the yard?
Well, stay in the yard where Ruth can keep an eye on you. And under no circumstances go farther than the garage.
Oh, no, sir. No farther. The tub water was only lukewarm against my foot as it gushed from the hot faucet, and after a minute it became uncomfortably cool. As I dried myself, I wondered if I would ever trade this body of sharp, thin lines for something more gentle, more womanly.
"Ruth," I called out from the bathroom, "do you have something for me to eat? I'm starved."
"Since when you begin asking for food and taking baths without being told?"
"Since always," I said, buttoning up a fresh white shirt.
Ruth shook her head.
"When God went and parted the Red Sea for the Israelites, that was a miracle, too."
The brown paper bag felt heavy between my teeth as I climbed up the stair ribs. A scent of salami liberally seasoned with pepper and garlic assaulted my nose and started up a series of small sneezes. As I sneezed only an arm's length from the door, I became frightened that he would be frightened. But before I could call his name, his hand reached down and touched mine.
"Gesundheit,"
he said, and smiled as though I was somebody special. "I brought you lunch and some fresh clothes," I said, surprised at my matter-of-fact tone. As Anton measured the Palm Beach trousers against his waist, I reached back into the sack and touched cardboard. The box was cocoa brown, and the cover came embossed with three golden acorns, the symbol of Oak Hall, the finest men's store in all of Memphis. Inside was the shirt, the Father's Day present. Not the Father's Day of a few weeks ago, but of a year before that. I remember how important it had seemed then to give something special, something of value. At first, my mother and I went to Goldsmith's, Memphis's largest store, and we found this perfectly nice sports shirt that she tried to talk me into buying.
"And you'll have two whole dollars left over from your birthday money to buy something nice for yourself," she told me.
When I said I wanted to walk over to Oak Hall to see their shirts, she got all worked up.
"It's just plain stupid to pay $2 more for a label. You got so much money you can throw it away. Don't you know labels are worn inside the collar when nobody can see them?"
But because my determination out-determined her determination, she told me to go by myself. I was to meet her back in Goldsmith's in exactly 1 hour on the fourth floor, better dresses. 1 whole hour of my very own. Freedom. Freedom. I felt happy and practically grown up. So I took the scenic side trip up in the elevator to the 7th floor book department. Over a table, a sign decorated with a painted teddy bear said children's books. Some were books that I had long ago passed through. A Treasury of Mother Goose and Beatrix Potter's The Tale of Peter Rabbit. Then there were the Bobbsey Twins and Winnie the Pooh. On the next table were stacks of the Hardy Boys and good old Nancy Drew. Her father is a hot-shot lawyer, but it takes Nancy to solve all the mysteries. It was in the adult section that I found the books I wanted to take home. The best stories of Guy de Maupassant, and another collection by O. Henry. Goldsmith's had some good books, beautiful books, and $5 would buy 2 or 3. When I glanced up, I saw a sales lady starting towards me, and I knew if she just said, "May I help you?" I'd buy de Maupassant and O. Henry. But instead, I turned and half-walking, half-running, made it back into the elevator with integrity and $5 still intact. Inconspicuously printed on the store window in gold Gothic letters were the words, Oak Hall since 1887, and just underneath, three golden acorns. Inside the heavy brass door, a middle-aged mannequin posed majestically with riding stick. He wore a deep blue shirt with a paisley ascot at his neck. A carefully attired salesman who, like the acorns, must have been with Oak Hall since 1887, took out stacks of size 15 sports shirts from behind a sliding glass door. Many of the shirts were marked $5 and $6, and some cost as much as $10. One was the exact shirt worn by the mannequin. The buttons were pearl, but dyed in perfect matching blue. My hand glided across the fabric, which had the smoothness of marble. The label read, Fine Egyptian Cotton. It was a shirt for presidents and premiers, princes and polo players. It took only a few minutes' wait for the initials HB to be ironed onto the pocket. But it was only by the greatest amount of self-control that I was able to check my impulse to present the shirt to my father that very night. Actually, I did cheat, but only a little, when I told him that I had bought him a perfectly wonderful Father's Day gift. When Sunday finally arrived, I felt the way I used to feel about Christmas. My imagination had played the scene over so many times. I knew that he would be pleased with my gift. He'd say it was the finest shirt he'd ever owned. And then the focus would shift from gift to giver, and I would rest there in his arms like a long-lost daughter come home. The reality wasn't like that. He opened the box, said thanks, and then, replacing the cover, he tossed it casually out of sight. But it's what happened next, what I did next, that even now makes me feel the painful pinch of shame. I brought the shirt back to him. Look, it has your initials, HB, I said. And see the buttons? Genuine pearl dyed to perfectly match the fabric, which is very special, too. Comes all the way from Egypt. With a sudden half-swing of his hand, he pushed both me and the shirt out of his way. I said thank you, he said, edging each word with finely controlled irritation. Anton asked me to excuse him while he went into the bathroom to change into the pants. It was then that I handed him the cocoa-colored box. A shirt. You'll need a shirt. I turned my head away. Maybe it isn't such a great shirt. Maybe he won't like it either. But I turned my head back just in time to see his face change from surprise to pleasure. His hand stroked the blueness, and his fingers even stopped momentarily to examine a button. Thanks, he said, touching my cheek with his hand. Then he was gone, and the room seemed emptier than it had ever before been. Probably it was just that before Anton, the room had grown accustomed to its loneliness. Anton came back, filling it up. His eyes looked blue now, very blue, like the shirt he wore. During our lunch, I told him about all the excitement in town and about my visit to the prison camp. He seemed confused by it all, especially about my interrogation by the FBI. Why is there such interest in me, an ordinary soldier? Only because they think you're a threat to our national security. Me? Because of the German saboteurs from the U-boats the FBI captured. They think you escaped to join up with them. U-boats were here, Patty? They just stopped long enough to let off the saboteurs. And they think I... Yes. It was the timing. It was the worst possible timing. But you're safe here, Anton.
You can stay here till the end of the war. Nobody knows about this place, and I can bring you food and books to read and anything else that you want. Tell me what you want.
Anton raised his eyes to look at me without raising his head.
A bit of your courage, P.B.
P.B., he called me, and my initials took on a strength and beauty that never before was there. And now that I had of my own free will broken faith with my father and my country, I felt like a good and worthy person.
Anton laughed, keeping it well within his throat. After the war, when I'm with my family again, I'll tell them about you. How an American Jewess protected me.
I searched through his words for even a slight implication that when he was with his family again, I'd be there too. But I couldn't find it. I was close to coming right out with it, asking him, begging if that would help, to let me go where he goes. Then my hand brushed across my hair, and I felt the forgotten, the tizzledly, frizzledy handiwork of Mrs. Reeves. The moment went sour.
"Tell me," he said, showing a perfect set of teeth like an advertisement for toothpaste.
"Why have you suddenly taken the vows of silence?"
A knot of anger rose up. Anger towards Mrs. Reeves, who uglified me, towards Anton, who pretended not to notice, but mostly against myself for believing that a prince could love a plowgirl.
"If I talked less, would you talk more?" he asked, still showing off his teeth. "Show off."
"No. It's only because I don't feel like any more talking. You want coffee? I'll bring you coffee."
As I reached for the door, I saw his hand reach out towards me, but I closed the door firmly between us. I found myself in front of the house and sat down on the steps, out of view of the garage. The carousel inside my brain began its revolutions. He's nice to me only because I'm useful. He's nice to me only because he likes me. He's handsome. I'm homely. Love is blind and beauty skin deep. He's laughing at me, with me. With me. Why did I have to find him? How could I endure losing him? My head dropped forward and rested in the dark hollow of my hands. Remember what they say. My father, mother, the clerks in the store, and the salesmen with heavy sample cases from Memphis, St. Louis, and Little Rock. You only get what you pay for. From somewhere a voice called my name. My eyes remained closed. At any moment he'll sit down next to me, and after a little quietness he will ask me to go away with him. You really want me to go with you? He'll nod his head, and I'll say, "Yes, Anton, yes."
"Looky here," said the voice close up. "I got me some salt pork for crawdaddin'."
"Freddie Dowd."
"I don't want to catch any crawdads, Freddie. I might have a headache."
How do you tell a boy who never has anything more to brag about than a piece of salt pork that you want him to go away?
Poor Freddie. So thin, like he never quite gets enough to eat.
He sat down next to me.
"Salt pork is what them crawdads would rather eat than anything in this here world."
"Have you ever tasted crawdad, Freddy?" He laughed, showing jagged areas where his teeth had darkened and decayed.
"Crawdads ain't for eatin', they's for catchin'." "Did you know that crawdads are in the same family as lobsters and crabs? The crustacean family,
and only people who are very, very rich can ever afford to taste them.
He looked at me like I was telling him the stars are stuck to the heavens with little bits of cellophane tape.
"I'm a-gonna ask my daddy," he said after an interval.
Freddie is getting very close to being 12 years old, and he still believes that being a grown-up man is the same as knowing things. Daddy Dowd is a big, slow-moving, slow-speaking man who delivers milk, but drinks something else.
Poor Freddie. You're not going to find many answers there.
Okay, so Freddie is simple. There are worse things than that. There's hypocrisy, for example, pretending to like somebody just so they can keep you safe from the FBI. And with Freddie, a person can feel comfortable because, from his miserable perch, he's not likely to be laughing at anybody. Sometimes I feel Freddie and I are related. Well, not exactly related as much as we share something that makes us both outcasts. Part of our outcastness has to do with simple geography. He is a country boy who, because of some accident of his daddy's job, lives right here in town. And my geography problem is in being a Jewish girl, where it's a really peculiar thing to be. Even when I went to Jewish Sunday school in Memphis, the geography thing was still there. I would come in on a cold Sunday morning wearing short-sleeved, short-legged union suits under my sash-tied dresses, while the other girls looked as though they were born into this world wearing matching sweater and skirt outfits. It struck me that neither of us had said anything for a while. I looked over at Freddie, who was busily picking at a piece of scab. How like Freddie to sit quiet and amuse himself when I don't feel like talking. One thing you can say about him is that he's appreciative. He's just happy having someone to sit with. Leaving downtown was the familiar roar of a car motor. Did all Chevys sound angry? It must be 6 o'clock. Moments later, I watched my father steer up a wide turn in front of the house and gun the car up the gravel driveway. "Oh, Harry, leave her alone," cried my mother through the open car window.
"Me? What did I—"
"Oh, God, it's Freddie. Where do I keep my mind?"
"Go, Freddie," I whispered. "Go home."
The car door slammed shut. My father's face was a pasty white.
"How dare you disobey me?"
"Please let me explain something to you." My hands automatically reached out in a gesture that looked futile even to me. My mother stationed herself between us.
"Now, Harry, leave her alone, please."
With one hand, he gave her a strong push that sent her staggering backward across the grass.
"God damn you," he shouted at me. "You'll obey me if it kills you."
My legs were carrying me in reverse toward the rear of the house. Let me at least tell you what happened. I was sitting there, and he just came over a moment ago and sat down. I swear to God that's the truth. His feet came faster, and I moved to keep space between us. The sounds of Ruth's kitchen radio, tuned into the gospel station, poured out the open window.
"Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go."
We were deep into backyard territory, and my eye caught sight of the garage hideout. God, don't let him see this. I tried to maneuver back toward the front of the house, but my arm was caught with an explosion of pain.
Ow!
My arm felt as if it was pulled out of its socket. Then the barrage.
No! Oh!
The ground reached up and laid me down. Oh, God, can't you help? Everything was quiet.
Was it all over?
It seemed too quick to satisfy him.
I forced my eyes open. He was standing over me, the brown of his suit in perfect outline against the white of the garage. His breath was coming in quick, heavy gasps, and I began to hope that his exhaustion would cut short the agony. Metal clicked against metal. A leather belt rushed through fabric loops. As the belt whipped backward, I saw Anton with raised fists racing toward my father's unsuspecting back.
"No!" I shouted. "Go away! Go away!"
The belt came down.
"Oh, no, no, no."
Anton, his hands outstretched before him, froze. His face was like I had never seen it, dazed with horror. Then he clapped his hands to his eyes and backed towards the garage.
Chapter 11.
She has to be taking it home with her. I can't think of any other explanation. That kosher salami costs $1.10.
My mother repeated the price a second time for added emphasis. I pulled the top sheet over my head to block out the early morning sounds from the kitchen and rolled over a now very warm ice bag and remembered. In another few minutes, they would be leaving for the store. Only then would I get out of bed. Just as soon as my mother downs her second cup of coffee and my father finishes his cornflakes. As long as I can remember, it has been cornflakes and nothing but cornflakes. He's got the same loyalty towards cars.
I'll buy any kind of car as long as it's Chevrolet.
And cigarettes, too. He's never had a cigarette in his mouth that wasn't a lucky strike.
So you better talk to her, Harry. Talk to who?
To Ruth!
Her voice hit a shrill note.
I want to know what's happening to the salami and chicken and all the other food that's been disappearing around here lately.
Well, how do you know she's taking it home? I don't know what you're talking about. She'll be coming any minute now, and if you want to fire her, it's fine with me. Something about that woman I never liked.
I didn't want to speak to them, but I didn't want them to suspect either. I yelled out,
I'm sorry about the salami, 'cause I ate most of it myself. And about the leftover chicken, Sharon and Sue Ellen ate the last of it.
Now you see that, he told her. Don't ever talk to me again about missing food.
I'll have to say this for him. He's always generous about food, even when we eat in restaurants. Like that Sunday in Memphis not too long ago when we ate at Britling's, and I ordered the chopped sirloin steak, and he said,
That's nothing but a hamburger. Wouldn't you like to have a real steak?
My mother didn't like the idea of ordering an expensive steak that'll just go to waste. But my father told her to mind her own business, and that as long as he lived, I could eat anything I wanted. The phrase, as long as he lived, sounded like a vague prophecy, and I became sorrowful that he might die now that he was being good to me. I became so sorrowful, in fact, that it was Mother's prediction that was soon fulfilled. An expensive steak went to waste. The familiar sounds of a spiritual. Ruth was passing below my window on her way to the back door.
"Morning, folks," she called. "Well, I heard the weatherman say we're going to get us a little rain by afternoon, enough to cool things off."
My mother agreed that a little shower would be very nice.
"Is that piece of toast all you've had to eat?"
asked Ruth.
"That's no kind of breakfast, Miss Bergen. I could make you some hurry-up griddle cakes."
"Griddle cakes are fattening.
Besides, I have to leave now.